Welcome to Fairbanks Arts Review. I'm Robert Gilfillan, your host. Tonight, we'll talk to John McCutcheon and listen to his music, and later hear about some new movies and books in town. So join me tonight on Fairbanks Arts Review.
Instrument on the wind that shakes the barley. You mentioned that you give a short history about the hammer dulcimer. What actually appeals to you about the hammer dulcimer?
Initially, like anybody who hears it for the first time, it was the sound of it. And visually, it's a really fascinating instrument to watch someone play because there seems to be a tremendous amount of music coming out of this box, and you know that only point of contact between the player and the instrument itself are these two little wooden mallets. But in the last 10 years, there has developed a style of playing and new techniques that have just produced a tremendous amount of music that can be gotten out of this instrument. And also, it's real versatility. I probably take more liberties with the hammer dulcimer as far as exploring new musical styles than with any other instrument, whether it be playing session work on rock and roll or Latin-flavored albums, to playing Irish harp pieces, to more standard square dance style music.
That's the musician John McCutcheon, and he's going to be up here at the university campus on Saturday at 8 o'clock. And we're going to continue our discussion with John about the hammer dulcimer and about traditional music in general. So stay tuned.
I noticed that you have a wide selection of music, so you seem to be rather eclectic in the sources. Do you think that Irish music, to take one, has a certain affinity for the hammer dulcimer?
Well, certainly the kind of rhythmic drive that is light but definitive, that's a part of Irish music, certainly goes well with the dulcimer. The dulcimer is one of the few string instruments that you can be really rhythmically percussive on. So, consequently, as a solo player, and there really aren't that many professional solo dulcimer players, more people tend to play in ensembles. It's been a real challenge for me, and a joy, too, to combine the kind of rhythmic things that are constantly going on in my head. If my parents had been foolish enough to buy me a set of drums as a teenager, I'd probably be a drummer now. But I can sort of let that all hang out and yet play the more melodic sounds that the dulcimer affords as well. And it's interesting because I have a number of other albums out other than what you've mentioned. My most recent one actually is a children's album called How to Do, where I use the dulcimer largely as an accompanying instrument for songs. But I also just finished an album which will be coming out this fall of Christmas and Hanukkah music. And on there, the dulcimer plays everything from old Hebrew songs to I use four hammer dulcimers to play a quartet from the Messiah. So it's been great being seen not only as a bastion of traditional playing in this country, but also as someone who's helping establish the frontiers that dulcimers are foraying into.
Well, as you mentioned before, I think it's something of a misnomer when we talk about old-time music, because actually, when we talk about it, it's actually a living tradition that stretches far back, that you build on the melodies that are you inherit and develop them and change them to suit your times and needs and moods.
Well, that's the whole definition of traditional music, is that it's something that grew out of the needs of a particular community or group of people and grew with them, so that because until, say, the last 70 years, when the recording industry has really started to document traditional music, it changed with every locale and generation. Now we have more artificial means of concretizing this tradition, where everybody says, well, this is the definitive version of Barbara Allen, and that simply was never the case before. But now if someone plays Fox on the Run, everybody's going to try to play it, you know, exactly like the famous artist who recorded it. And in a way, it could stagnate it, but I think a lot of people that I know, and I certainly try to be one of them, that realizes that I'm a person who's, you know, 32 years old, and I grew up, you know, in a rural area, but not in the same kind of rural area that the music I'm playing came out of. And I'm a young person in 1984, and so consequently, the music I'm playing, the music I'm choosing, the music, the way I play it, and the songs I'm writing tend to reflect a very contemporary consciousness, as traditional music did throughout time.
Well, then, am I right in sensing a certain ambivalence between about the electronic medium?
No, I think it's people's reaction to it. I guess you could say that I'm a little bit ambivalent about it, because what it does tend to do is it tends to take moments of time and lock them into something forever, which was never the case traditionally. If I sang a song and you heard it, you had to remember it, because there was no other way to remember it, you know, to bring it back. It's changed people's memories. Most of the old people that I've collected from and worked with have tremendous memories. And now, today, we don't have to have good memories. We have videotapes and cassette recorders, and we don't know how to listen to one another. And that's one of the reasons that that people find traditional music hard to learn in some cases, because they don't know how to listen. They have to force themselves to do it, and it's not written down, by and large. But other than that, I think it's changed. It's changed things for the better, because we now can know what Bob Wills sounded like when he played the fiddle, and I would have no idea what that was, because I was never privileged enough to hear him play, or hear Roscoe Holton play the banjo, or Sarah Carter sing. I'm glad we have those things, because I can share the way that I learned and the music I love, whether I'm playing it or someone else is playing it, with a whole lot of people. Thank you.
bit about the people who are influential to you as a hammer dulcimer player, as a fiddler, or just an all-around musician. Who did you go to learn your craft and your art?
Well, I started off like a lot of young kids back in the 60s started off. It was during the big, what's jokingly called among folk artists now, the folk scare of the 60s, when folk music became very commercial and it was available to a lot of people. So I grew up hearing people like Peter, Paul, and Marion, and I thought that was real pretty music, and it caught my ear because it was very different from the other kind of music I was hearing on the radio. And then I heard Pete Seeger and Woody Guthrie, and I thought, now that's folk music. It's a little rawer than what I'm hearing, the sweet harmonies and everything. So I listened to that for a while, and then I started picking up albums of field recordings, especially one called Old Time Music at Clarence Ashley's, which is a Folkways release. And I found it in the college library, and it featured Doc Watson as a young man before he was discovered, and old fiddle players and banjo players and singers who simply got together at Clarence Ashley's home, and a folklorist happened to be there with a tape recorder and taped it, put out a record of it, and just turned my head around that here was real soul music. This was people playing the music that talked about their lives, came out and let people know that they were there because their ancestors had been strong. And it was really exciting music. And so I packed up my banjo, which is what I was primarily playing then, and hitchhiked down here into the South, and I met people like Roscoe Holcomb and Sarah and Maybelle Carter and Jeanette Carter and the great mountain dulcimer player I.D. Stamper and fiddler Tommy Jarrell and a whole crew of other people, too numerous to mention, that taught me about this music. Not only where to put my fingers, but where to put my head and my heart at the right place and time. And that's as important as having your fingers in the right place.
If he ain't moved away, he's a living there still, singing I-diddle-I-diddle-I-fi-diddle-I-diddle-I-day. Well, the devil came up to the farmer one day, said, one of your family I'm going to take away, I-diddle-I-diddle-I-fi-diddle-I-diddle-I-day. Please don't take my eldest son, there's work on the farm that's got to be done, singing I-diddle-I-diddle-I-fi-diddle-I-diddle-I-day. But you can't have my nagging wife, by heaven she's the curse of my life, singing I-diddle-I-diddle-I-fi-diddle-I-diddle-I-day. So he threw the old lady up upon his back, went off to hell with a clickety-clack, singing I-diddle-I-diddle-I-fi-diddle-I-diddle-I-day.
Do you find, for you as a performer, that you're able to express yourselves in an auditorium setting?
Well, like any artist, I have an idea, or more correctly, a series of ideas that I want to be conveying to an audience. I really feel that a concert performance or a festival performance where I'm able to share some of myself, my music, and my ideas with an audience is really my primary form of communication. Records are, that's another whole different ball game. It's a different way of thinking about performance. And as you've seen in my more recent records, I tend to use more than just myself. And recordings are not live performances. So what I look to is having that concert performance where I can talk about the path that led us all to where we are now and where we are now and where we might be going in the future. And so that includes using traditional songs, using songs about what's happening in the world now, using songs I've written, using songs by friends of mine like Cy Khan to express the ideas that I want to be expressing. And music is a medium, and that medium is transported by the people who taught me and by my interpretation of it now. Because I guess what I would call myself is, an old wave musician.
Well, that's interesting that you should say those things, because In a strange way, I have a feeling, and I have no data to back this up, but that supposedly traditional or old-time music is there's a resurgence of interest in it, and it's being treated with much more seriousness and attention than it was, let's say, even 10, 15 years ago.
I think a lot of that is the kind of visibility that it has now, and the fact that in the last 10 years there has been a tremendous reconsideration of what this, quote, old-time music is, and people, by and large, expressing it as living parts of their lives, or as their lives, rather than simply museum pieces that were meant to be, spewed right back out as they were digested from old 78 recordings or dusty field recordings, because no traditional musician ever tried to sound exactly like his or her mother or father or neighbor or guru of any sort. You know, they put a little bit of themselves in. One of the greatest tributes I've always felt that I could give to my mentors, teachers, friends, and audiences is to show that what I've really learned from these many fine traditional musicians is to bring what's inside outside. And that's an important thing for an artist to do.
What type of music or what selection of pieces are you going to bring to Fairbanks with you?
Well, it'll be a wide range of things. I like to take people through a big ride. I'll be singing songs about children and songs for children. I'll be singing songs about love and loss of that love, and I'll be singing songs about our neighbors in America here and in other parts of the world, singing songs of our history that expresses hope for the future. And a lot of that will be contemporary music, a lot of it will be traditional music, a lot of it will be stuff I've just recently written. We'll be playing fiddle and hammer dulcimer, and banjo and guitar and auto harp and jaw harp, and I'll even be playing my body for some ham bones. But all in all, I think what's going to happen is each of the selections I tend to frame in some kind of a picture, so that if someone has never, for instance, thought that what the song John Henry is about a fellow who's going to be replaced by a machine and decides to do something about it, they'll realize how contemporary a song like John Henry is and why it's lasted so long and how me, having heard John Henry from age 9, affected my thoughts about old-time music and the world and who my role models were and how that is reflected then in the songs I write and the way I play the music. So, they're going to have I think we'll all have a really great time. I'm really looking forward to getting up there.
Traditional, let's say, Irish musicians, John Cunningham comes to mind just at the top of my head, or people like that, they'll experiment with electronic, like synthesizers.
Mm-hmm.
Have you done that, and if not, why, and where do you see your music going in the future?
Hmm. That's an interesting question. I think that there tends to be a kind of myopic vision of what kind of progression traditional music players are supposed to take. I feel like I've done a tremendous amount of experimentation. My whole approach to old-time music was very revolutionary at the time I started playing it, because I played it with, as Bruce Kaplan, the head of Flying Fish Records, recently told me, with a freshness that made you think that this song had just been made up. And that's the way I feel about these songs. They're very alive to me, not only because of the music itself, but because of the people I learned them from. So I, rather than solely going in the direction of electronic instruments, and there is actually a synthesizer on this new Christmas album that I've used on one song. I've, on the same album, there is a very Hebrew sound. Well, it is one of the most popular songs in the Hebrew repertoire, Erev Shel Shoshanim, which has a very Yiddish flavor to it with a hammer dulcimer based sound. On the same album, there will be a string quintet from the Washington Bach Consort that came in to help me out with the Handel piece, as well as a traditional Huron Native American song. But a lot of the music I'm writing these days has a decidedly contemporary feel. So for some of the things I've recorded for future albums are actually using, would actually use drums or bass. I tend to have less qualms about that, because I think I've made what I've been making the statement in more recent records is that this is my music, and it I've learned it from these sources, and I'm grateful and very respectful and vocal about the places I learned my traditional music from. But as you'll see on my children's album, How'd You Do, there's an old rock and roll song on it, the old Peanut Butter song, and there's a Zydeco treatment of a Psycon song called Rubber Blubber Whale, and all kinds of different things. So it's basically what, album-wise, what fits in it, and also in the mood of the concert, if I play a little more contemporary-sounding thing on the guitar or the dulcimer or the banjo or something. I don't think I ever throw people for a loop in that regard. It's just what suits the music and what kind of framework I can put it in that brings every bit of meaning out that I want to convey. But I'm not as upset as some people might suspect that an old traditionalist might be when I hear people like Johnny having synthesizers on their records or drums like Stan Rogers. Mm-hmm. Had many of his records. I think it's whatever works for the people. And I think if we want people to pay attention to old-time music, exposing it alongside of a lot of other kinds of music is an important thing to do, so that they see that this is just as much a part of our life today as the police are. There's trouble all the time, and no one knows the inward grief of my poor troubled mind. Oft times I've suffered for your sake. It's you I love so dear. Oh, I wish that I could go with you, or you would carry here. And oh, my mother loved me well. My father treated me kind, but for your sake I'd go with you and leave them both behind. I do concerts. That's what pays the bills. I do workshops in all kinds of things, everything from the expected how to play the hammer dulcimer to how to collect folklore in your community to the political ramifications of traditional music. I also play for school children. I play for older citizens. I play for political rallies. I play for, other friends of mine and some people I don't know on record albums. And all this is tied in somehow, even though most people tend to think people like myself just do concerts because that's the most visible thing that we do. But the teaching, the writing, instruction methods and writing songs, it's all part of a concerted effort to educate myself and the people who I deal with, whether they be concert audiences or workshop participants, in my view of how I would like to see the world. And we all use the tools that we are given and that we develop or that we find. And whether it be talking about peace and justice or people taking control of the entertainment that they're able to generate in their own lives by playing their own music, or understanding their past and their communities by collecting folklore and understanding families, or just hopefully starting a group of kids in a little daycare center off on the right foot for that day with a couple songs that they can all sing together. It all is directed by the idea that I was given somehow the gift to make people feel good and feel sad and laugh and cry, and think about things a little differently. And I'm forever puzzled by it, but I just try to keep plugging along and use those to the best advantage of myself, my community, and the world. Yeah. There's also points at which myself and other artists I know realize that they've made enough point of contact with their audiences that they can talk about harder things to talk about. And not all music is meant, not all art is meant to make people feel good. So I think when people come and see me in Fairbanks, they're going to hear some songs that will not only make them feel good, but they'll also hear songs that will make them think, that might make them feel sad, but that tell real human stories, and I think it's all folk music in that regard. So there's a great movement these days among acoustic style musicians, and I was just at a workshop for a week up in upstate New York with a big crew of such folks, of perhaps being more intentional in our notion of what is going on in our lives, in our world now, so that we can address them sensitively and intelligently, and our audiences can as well, because I think there's a lot of concern for many different issues, whether it be people being able to take control of their traditional music so that it's not wiped out by Nashville, all the way to who is justly, fairly, and peaceably running our lives. So there's a lot of different ways to go about it, and sometimes one approach works and sometimes another approach works, but my tack has always been to try to combine the two, because I think more than anything else, audiences don't want to be impressed, they want to be moved. Mm-hmm. And whether that's moved to laughter or tears or joy or warmth, the whole idea in my mind, is that an artist should empower his audience and make them feel good about themselves, that they have, if something has to be done, that they have the power to do it. That's an important thing for artists.
That was the musician John McCutcheon discussing his music with us. And as any of you know, he's a very fine musician and one of the finest preservers and interpreters of Appalachian old time and traditional music. And you can hear him Saturday night at 8 o'clock at the concert hall at the university campus. Thank you. Well, Laurel Stalky is a regular on our show, and she's back with a rundown of the September films playing in Alaskaland. But with her for the first time is her silent partner, Eric, her husband. And it was he that pointed out to me that fans of Local Hero and Gregory's Girl, would probably relish next week's movie. It's entitled That Sinking Feeling.
It's his first film. It was made for $14,000, which has got to be a near record for a film that's released.
Very
anymore.
Low budget. Yeah.
Now, is this the film that he did with the high school students?
That's right. A bunch of unknown Scottish students. It was his first film before he had made a name for himself, and for that reason, it really hasn't been shown. But after the success of Gregory's Girl and Local Hero, they started digging back to see what else he had made. They came up with this one. It was released in New York a few months ago and has had a great success, although it was just filmed in 16 millimeter.
Really?
And it's kind of a grainy print, and there's a lot of low production values, but apparently it's a very funny film.
What's the running time on that?
Well,
about 90?
It's 82 minutes.
82 mm-hmm. minutes.
Yeah.
He was reluctant to have it released in New York City because it lacks the polish of his other later films, but the critics in New York City thought it was deserving to come out, and you could see why Gregory's Girl and Local Hero were no accident, that they were a good success. Same type of humor.
So tell me a little bit about the plot of That Sinking Feeling.
Well, it revolves around a group of young people that are unemployed and terminally stupid, I guess.
Maybe marginally educated.
Marginally, yeah. They don't have a lot going for them. It's just a street gang. And they hatch up this plot to make a bunch of money by stealing some sinks from a hardware store.
takes place in Glasgow, which I understand is sort of a dead-end place to live now because of the, you know, industry there and no employment. And at the beginning of the film, there's a disclaimer that says, the action in this film takes place in Glasgow, but any resemblance to any real town called Glasgow is purely coincidental. Really, it is about that, though.
And that's playing September 10th through the 12th. And following that is Federico Fellini's And the Ship Sails On. And I haven't heard anything about this film.
I think it's like other Fellini films in that it's kind of an observation of people, characters, strange characters. People call them Fellini people. They say, who's in it? You know, well, no one is in it that I've ever heard of or that is even known in Europe. But he chooses people because of their interesting faces or their out-of-date look or something that's interesting about them, and they carry the film along that way. The gist of the film is it's an ocean voyage, takes place on a luxury liner. It's full of artists and officials and people who were friends of an opera singer who recently died. And the purpose of the voyage is to go and scatter her ashes on an island in the Adriatic Sea. Okay, there's a lot of strange characters on board, including a rhinoceros.
A rhinoceros.
Right.
Okay.
So it's mostly a comedy, kind of a salute to artists, I think. And it takes place on the eve of World War I. And reality breaks in at one point in the film when they run into a battleship, but it doesn't really affect them too much. And I think the point is kind of artists can sail on, oblivious to what's happening in the world situation.
So it doesn't draw any grim moral lessons about the responsibility of the artist to the rest of the world?
I don't think
probably
so.
Probably
no.
Just the opposite of that. I think reality has very little to do with this film. The ocean is made out of cellophane, and all the props are obviously
so it's surrealistic in a way.
Yeah,
there's a scene where a chicken's being hypnotized by someone singing, and it's obvious that the chicken's mechanical, you know, and it doesn't matter. I don't know. It sounds interesting. I can't
wait
to see
that.
That's
a good career, hypnotizing mechanical chickens. When was this produced?
1984.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
This year.
It's the most recent film by Fellini.
What kind of reviews has it received? Have you heard anything about it?
Mostly good, yeah.
Really? Well, you know, he's such a fine film director, but with a lot of film directors, they have a certain consistency in their style. And with Fellini, I mean, his style is pretty consistent, which is to say it's bizarre. He never does anything commonplace
right,
or pedestrian.
Right, not in a usual way. You don't know what to expect next. It's not a plot
right.
Here, you know, ABC, and then it ends in a conclusion. No.
It has been mentioned a lot that he's sort of gone back to not really his old style of filmmaking, but at least to his Amarcord stage with his film.
Oh, really?
Right. He's left, you know, there's nothing, I don't think, depressing or serious about this film. And it's not like City of Women, which I didn't care for. I think it's going to be a whole different thing. It starts out in an interesting way. It starts out in black and white, silent movie type image. Then it goes to sepia tones, and they kind of bleed into real muted colors. And I think that sounds wonderful. I want to see that.
It does sound exciting. Mm-hmm. When does the And the Ship Sails On play?
That's playing Monday through Wednesday, September 17 through 19.
Okay, and that's 120-minute running time.
Mm-hmm, so it's a long one.
2 hours. Well, that's good. And then coming up is Laura, which is a classic. I never knew Otto Preminger directed that with Dana Andrews and Clifton Webb. I don't know. It's pretty well a classic. Isn't it a cult classic?
Well, it's generally considered one of the best thrillers ever made. I know I've seen it before on television, but it's been so long ago that I'm looking forward to seeing it again.
I remember watching it on television when I was younger and having a strong impact on me, and I didn't know anything about the film then. I mean, I wasn't told that it was an impressive film or that it had a large impact. For our listeners, we better describe somewhat about Laura if they don't know.
Oh, it's a detective genre. Perfect example of the detective genre. I'm reading off my schedule here. Dana Andrews plays a detective, and he's hired to investigate the death of this woman, Jean Tierney. And she turns up alive. I don't know the rest of the plot, but it has to do with examining the motives of all the suspects, all the murderers. And they're all very sophisticated. Clifton Webb gives a good performance, and Vincent Price is also in this film.
What impressed me when I watched the film was the fact that the detective gradually falls in love with Laura, or Jean Tierney, before he even meets her.
Mm.
You know, through his investigation, talking to each of the people, you draw this wonderful portrait. And in fact, that there's a parallel in the film because there's this portrait of Laura that he keeps looking at. He keeps going back to her apartment and seeing this beautiful portrait of her. And after talking to all these suspects, he gradually falls in love, but you get, as a viewer and through his eyes, this really interesting composite picture of her, so that when she enters the scene, the impact's all that much greater.
Mm.
It's really a marvelous film. Do you have any weekend films? You had a couple.
Yeah, we do. Laura plays Monday through Wednesday,
mm-hmm.
the 24th through the 26th, and then coming up on Friday, Saturday, the 28th and 29th, is Broadway Danny Rose, the new Woody Allen film.
I'm really looking forward to that.
Mm-hmm. Even for people who aren't fans of Woody Allen, myself included.
Oh, no.
Yes, it's true.
Well, we'll have to conclude this interview.
No, but in reading about it, again, I haven't seen it because it's a brand new film. It says this is a film to please both Woody Allen fans and his critics. So,
really?
Yeah.
Well, you know, lately with Woody Allen, I've been noticing he's been getting more technical and cerebral in his storylines. So you have that sort of meta structure with the story within the story within the story taking place, like in Stardust Memories and some of his other films.
I think this, like the Fellini film, the new one, it's come back to an older style. It's Woody Allen when he was funny. His earlier films. It's not like Zelig or Stardust Memories. It doesn't go for that. It goes for characters and big laughs. Maybe you can tell them, Eric, a little about the plot.
Well, it's almost a Chaplin-esque film. I think Woody Allen's been going through these phases. He tried to be Bergman for a while, and he tried to be Fellini for a while. Now he's apparently going after Charlie Chaplin this time. But probably a little bit of Fellini thrown in. He plays kind of a down-and-out movie or a artist agent on Broadway, and he has a cast of characters that he hauls with him, a skating rabbi, a parrot that sings I Gotta Be Me, a blind xylophonist, among others, and a lot of good lines, a lot of sight gags and things like that.
Now, Mia Farrow plays the female lead, and she plays a brassy blonde, and they say you have to look 2-3 times before you can recognize that's Mia Farrow with his, they call it Leaning Tower of Pisa hairdo and shades. She's a kind of a mall. She's in with the gangsters in New York.
Well, Woody Allen's one of my heroes, and I'm really looking forward to Broadway Danny Rose because I have read reviews of it too. And for me, his later films, his last couple of films have been pretty disappointing in a lot of ways. There was this story I saw recently where they had a picture of Woody Allen out of sleeper, and underneath was the caption, "Blithering intellectual." I thought that summed it up all. Anyway, and now that's a weekend film again.
Uh-huh, that's Friday, Saturday. That's the end of the month, September 28th and 29th.
Okay, let's quickly go back. Maybe we should go back backwards. And so we have Broadway Danny Rose on the 28th and 29th.
Mm-hmm.
And Laurel, which is the 24th through the 26th, Monday through Wednesday. And The Ship Sails On, Federico Fellini's, on September 17th through the 19th. And again, that's Monday through Wednesday, as is September 10th through the 12th, Bill Forsythe, who did Gregory's Girl, That Sinking Feeling.
Mm-hmm.
Well, thank you for coming along, and I guess we'll see you in 4 weeks talking about some other films.
Thank you, Robert.
Thank you.
Thank you, Robert.
We'll have to take it all over again.
That was Laurel and Eric Stahlke of Alaskaland Cinema describing the cinematic fair this month at Alaskaland. Literature isn't one of the fine arts we've considered very often on the show, and to rectify that, I invited Lynn Baker of Baker & Baker Booksellers on to discuss some of the new titles in town.
Let's start off with maybe the paperbacks, because I know for a lot of people who share my pocketbook constraints, paperbacks are usually what we can afford. So what do you recommend? What new books of worthy note are out in paperback?
Okay, paperbacks, even though they're more affordable, are still getting up there in price. One I'm looking at right now that I recommend is Winter's Tale by Mark Helprin, and I see it has a $4.50 price tag on it, but it's well worth every penny, the $4.50. This book was out 2 years ago. I guess it came out in hardcover, and it's just been released in paperback.
Well, he's an interesting writer. I read Refiner's Fire by him, and I enjoyed it quite a bit, and he has a very nice prose style. He also plays around a little bit with fantasy, or unreality breaks into what we call reality at certain points to add tension and create catalytic movements in the story, it seems to me. Is this true, do you think, with Winter's Tale?
It's very true with Winter's Tale. It's set in New York and just outside of New York, and then in some paradise that's not any part of New York, that they have to travel. They travel through the heavens on the horse. The horse is a very real horse, and he's a very magical horse at the same time. It talks about furious battles. The horse is killed, but the horse comes back to life.
Did it, for you, detract at all from the book that he throws such a liberal dose of fantasy into the book?
For me, it didn't, because I like books with a lot of fantasy in them. I don't read any science fiction or fantasy, but I think that the fantasy is necessary to, a lot of times, to illustrate a point that's almost unillustratable. He could have set this all in reality. He could have made the same points if he had set it in New York at a certain time. But I think leaving it open, and he leaves it open when it's in fantasy. There is no definite ending, and that's what I like about a lot of books. There's no sure conclusion.
Would you call it a powerful book?
Very.
Okay, what's the other paperback then that you brought along?
The other one is a novel called During the Reign of the Queen of Persia. The author is Joan Chase, and this book too is about 2 years old. It tells the story of a family in the Midwest. The grandmother is the Queen of Persia. She's the head of the household. And it's very realistic. There's no fantasy in this one at all. And it's just an excellent, I think, rendering of life in the Midwest at this time with a strong woman.
At this time, is that the 50s?
Yeah, it is the 50s.
And I wonder what the title, Queen of Persia, refers to. Just the woman in the household and how she is the matriarch?
Yes, And it was a nickname. Her husband called her that because she had her attitudes and her ways. And she's the strong, she is the matriarch. It is a matriarchal family, a farm family. And you watch the farm kind of disappear, but you watch the women through three generations watch over the farm, kind of keep their eye on what the men are doing, but that's about it. And again, it's one of those books that you pick up, but you can't put it down.
What books have you brought along in the hardback line that we can look forward to that are newly released?
Okay, new. Robert Heinlein has a new book out, Job, A Comedy of Justice. And Mary Catherine Bateson has done a biography of Margaret Mead and Gregory Bateson, her parents. And the other new one in hardcover, which has been out probably 2 months, is Jane Ann Phillips' Machine Dreams, which has probably gotten the most attention out of those three. I think With a Daughter's Eye will get a lot more reviews as time goes on and has gotten excellent reviews so far.
The book I want to talk about that you brought in and that I have actually read is The Women of Brewster Place by Gloria Naylor. And reading in the notes when I was looking at it, this is her first novel, and it's a stunning novel, not only stylistically for me, but just the compassion and insight and character development of character that takes place in the novel is stunning. And it's an interesting way of approaching it. It says it's a novel in seven mm-hmm. stories, and that's exactly what it is, and they all interweave, and it's an intriguing concept of presentation. It's about black women who live on the street, Brewster Place, and it's what the way they describe it is a blind alley feeding into a dead end.
Mm-hmm.
Brewster Place, a blind alley feeding into a dead end. And that is really stunning because that is exactly how the novel progresses. I mean, a blind alley. I hate to get too analytical about it, but, you know, our lives being blind insofar mm-hmm. as we don't know what our ends. And for many of the women here, it is a dead end where they end up.
That's what is interesting in the woman, Kizwana Brown, that moves to Brewster Place, and she wants to raise money to have the wall torn down and get back out into the world. And I just don't see that for most of those women at Brewster Place. But I remember when I first was interested in it, came out, it was originally released in hardcover, and a company's catalog is so different than a book review. And it got an excellent review in there. She is a powerful writer, and I think that that's why, along with a lot of black writers today, there are a lot of popular black writers today, and it's interesting to see the difference. It's interesting to see what... I read The Color Purple, finally. It took me quite a while to read that.
Alice Walker's book.
Mm-hmm. And found that... I really liked that one. But the Gloria Naylor book was in a different time and place. It was more a place I could identify with. It's not so much a story as Color Purple was, but yet it's such a powerful story.
And the way some of her, I'm almost tempted to read certain sections, although I couldn't do justice to it, because you just have to have the right type of reader to really get the rhythm and beauty of the language, do justice to the rhythm and beauty of the language. But some of her descriptions and her metaphors are mm-hmm. just staggering. I mean, really staggering. After reading it, you do come away with a certain heightened sense and perception about the world around you. I mean, and that's what's another fine thing that I found about The Women of Brewster Place was the fact that in spite of it being about black women and their life experiences, it translated so well for me, just as a human being, a white male, and obviously not in either Brewster Place or in the South at all, but in Alaska, I still found that her insights and the insights gleaned from this book were applicable to my life. And I really highly recommend it, as of course you do too, Lynn.
Good too.
The Women of Brewster Place.
But that's what I find about the characters are also... A lot of the writing today, or a lot of the characters, are probably people that are out there and they've lost touch with themselves. They've lost so much, and I know this has been going on in writing for a long time. But Gloria sticks to such basic human emotions. They're all in the place they are because of their simple, basic emotions. There's nothing... they talk about Brewster Place being on the other side of the educated and rich people live in Linden Hills, which is on the other side of the wall someplace. And in Brewster Place, that's where the uneducated and the poor are. But their feelings, they are, it's their human feelings that keep getting them in these, in the messes that they get into. There's nothing educated and ethereal about anything, and it's so real and it's so human. There's the passage in there with Kizwana Brown's mother when she's changed her name to Kizwana, and her mother had named her Melanie after her great-grandmother, and the mother is saying, like, why did you have to change your name to Melanie? I mean, to Kizwana. And she said, it's my African heritage and I must go back to that. And her mother, I can see her mother, her descriptions are so real. I can see her standing there saying, telling about her great-grandmother, Melanie, and how proud she is of her family and how hard she worked to give Kizwana everything she wanted so that she would never have to feel unworthy. Both sides of the coin are there, and Gloria Naylor does so well in showing them both.
Yeah. And because she's such a fine writer, and I think that the real inspiration, the real growth of literature are coming from people like Gloria Naylor or Alice Walker, because it seems to me no matter how fine the style of let's say, John Barth or John Updike is, essentially, or Philip Roth is another example that comes to mind, it's the same old, tired, jaded story of a writer or an intellectual who's jaded, who looks at the world through cynical eyes. For me, a lot of the imagination, the richness of the imagination, has been lost in fiction, and I think the new source of that inspiration and imagination is coming from people like Gloria Naylor and Alice Walker and some of these disenfranchised people who are finally finding the voice and eloquently finding a voice to express their reality. Well, let's go quickly over the books then that we mentioned so that people will... Yeah, I know we went on about The Women of Brewster Place, but, I mean, for me, that was a real stunning book, and I'd like to recommend it. And that's put out by Penguin Press, The Women of Brewster Place by Gloria Naylor. And then let's go back and talk about With a Daughter's Eye, and, which is by...
Mary Catherine Bateson, the daughter of Gregory and Margaret Mead. Margaret Mead and Gregory Bateson. Robert Heinlein's new book, Job, A Comedy of Justice, hardcover also. The Machine Dream, Jane Ann Phillips, I would say is equal to Woman of Brewster Place almost. I highly recommend that one. And again, it's the feelings and the emotions that are in that one. It's a brother and sister growing up, and the brother goes to Vietnam. It's very contemporary. And again, it's very real. Human emotions are in that one. The same with During the Reign of the Queen of Persia.
And that's a paperback.
By Joan Chase.
Mm-hmm.
And Mark Helprin's Winter's Tale.
Great. Well, a fine selection of books, and we'll look forward to you coming back on the show in a month or so.
Thanks, Robert.
Thanks, Lynn.
That was Lynn Baker of Baker & Baker Booksellers discussing some newly released books. Thanks for listening. And my thanks, as always, to Carla Tanella for her assistance. Join me in 2 weeks for another edition of Fairbanks Arts Review. For KUAC, I'm Robert Gilfillan. Good night.